You're listening to Second Breaks. I'm Lou Blazer.
Hello, hello, my friend. In this episode today, you're going to hear my conversation with Jen Berlingo. Jen is a coach, a licensed counselor, a nationally registered art therapist, and the author of the book, Midlife Emergence. In her book, Jen talked about the transformation that she went through, but unlike many other books of the same sort of genre or topic, and what I really liked about Jen's book is that Jen's a licensed professional therapist. And so she's not only sharing her experience with us, which is beneficial in its own right, but she also was providing us with a way to process our own experiences based on her years of professional training, her personal experiences, and client work. In this episode, we talked about the concept of emergence in midlife, why this happens, why this is normal to begin with, how this happens, and how we can answer the call to ask ourselves those super critical questions at this stage in life. Now, this is a long episode and I didn't really want to edit it more than I already did because it's so rich. It's a rich conversation with so many gems. So I'm going to do something that I've not done before in the podcast. I'm going to not add any more editorializing here, but instead we'll do a kind of response episode in a couple of weeks where I will share my thoughts about the topics, the things that we discussed in this episode, because my friend, I have thoughts. All right, so here we go. It'll just be a quick interjection from me somewhere in the middle of the episode and then a short outro to close the loop. But then I'll chat back with you about all of this in 2 weeks' time. Okie dokie, here's my conversation with Jen Berlingo. Your book is titled Midlife Emergence. You use the word emergence, which I was very attracted to, or, you know, struck with that word immediately as soon as I heard the title of your book. And of course, within your book, you also shared some definitions of the word.
Yes.
So I was wondering if we could start there, just kind of level set. What is it about this word that resonated with you? Why did you choose the word emergence in your book as your book title?
I love this question. I'll start a bit with midlife because that's defined as the period between like 40 and 65, roughly. Mm-hmm. And the stereotypical midlife crisis historically centers like the male experience, and they talk about it as a crisis or an emergency. But I feel like it doesn't need to be that. It can be an emergence, which is a little bit of play on the word emergency.
Ah.
And the word emergence, yeah, it's defined as the process of coming into view or becoming exposed after being previously concealed. So I like that reframe because it feels like an emergence of our more authentic selves after we've had the courage to challenge and either like change or shed some of the conditioning that we might have lived into in the first half of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, for me personally, I just noticed such a marked difference when I entered my 40s, which is like a decade that I feel like is the liminal space between act one and act two of life, where we have this opportunity to architect the second half of life the way we want it to be. So emergence for me felt really relevant because it was sort of like I was unveiling in midlife what in me had been previously unseen.
Yeah, I love these words that you used, to be honest. There are a couple other phrases that I wanted to chat with you about. But I also loved just now that you used the word liminal space and that kind of stuff, because they're very evocative and they, you know, just these words kind of make you feel something, or it's so, how do I explain this? Even though I'm not exactly sure about what it is that's happening with me, these words just kind of bring out the emotion or the feeling behind them.
Right.
So there's another word I wanted to, like I said, I wanted to just bounce off with you before we get deeper into this conversation. You use the word, somewhere in the book, you talk about traversing the midlife portal, which is another, you know, phrase, a combination of words that I loved. Can you just riff on that a little bit?
Of course. Yeah. So like I said, I feel like the 40s is like that liminal space, right? So it's the portal that we traverse between the first and second act of life, like a portal being a doorway or an mm-hmm. entrance, which implies that we're like entering a new space, right? So yeah, I think of the 40s as like looking into who we've been before we enter it. And we're also looking into the mystery that lies ahead and making decisions about what we want to let go of and what we want to call into our lives. So, you know, even though midlife's like 40s through mid 60s, even maybe affecting us a few years on either side of that, this entry point or this like portal is around 40, or if we're speaking astrologically, it's actually 42, which astrologers call the Uranus opposition. But I think of that as like a doorway into a new phase.
Right. And then just one more phrase, and then I'll double back and just ask some more questions about some of the stuff that you've already mentioned. But, and this might actually get into it, because there's a part in your book where you talked about the second individuation process. Did I pronounce that correctly? Second individuation process. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'll have some follow-up questions, but can you just introduce the topic? What is the first individuation process, and why is this the second individuation process?
Sure. Yeah. This is a term from developmental psychology. So with my background in counseling, I kind of come at it from that lens. But Carl Jung defined individuation as the process of a person becoming a psychological individual, or like a separate, unique identity. And the first pass that we have at this is when we individuate from our caregivers in adolescence. I know earlier you do have an individuation as a baby, like from the mother, but really individuation in a conscious way starts happening, you know, as teenagers, where a teenager will rebel from their caregivers or start really forming an identity separate from that of their family. So the second pass at that, being in midlife, that happens because in developmental psychology, midlife is a time that's referred to as a second adolescence often, because we're undergoing identity formation again. And the reason we're doing that this time, it's not necessarily from our family or our caregivers, but it can be. It's more from separating what our inner values are from what we've been conditioned to be or become by society or by culture. So, you know, we're looking at all of these like layers we maybe have put upon ourselves about what we should have been, and then saying like, are those actually aligned with who I am inside? And what do I need to let go of that doesn't serve me anymore? And then, you know, it's like separating the truest self and the most authentic self from maybe the personas we've adopted or the hats that we wear in different parts of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Which is sadly what people refer to as midlife crisis.
Exactly. Right. But I like the spin on it of emergence, because it feels like embracing an opportunity to actually emerge from those conditioned parts of ourselves and into what is more truly us. I mean, it can feel really challenging at midlife, especially because we don't really have a lot of, you know, cheerleaders or support, or, you know, even social support around becoming something else when we're surrounded by people who expect us to maybe be who we've always been to them. But we, like everything in nature, are always changing. So to give ourselves permission to change and grow, and others around us permission for that too, it feels like one of the tasks at this time of life. But it's really hard when we're settled into relationships and careers and mortgages and kids maybe, or caring for elders. It's like there's so many things that it's like, gosh, I can't shake the foundation of this necessarily. And I'm feeling this quaking of like, I need to actually be more generative and grow more into who I'm supposed to be and who I want to be here without regrets.
You know? So. Just one more other question from a psychological perspective, because I'm talking to a professional right now. I'll take advantage of it. But like, sure. So, I mean, you know, yes, there's this midlife crisis sort of like ugly phraseology that's out there that I don't like myself. But so from my psychology perspective, or like developmental perspective, this is a normal thing that happens to all of us, or most of us anyway, who want to admit it, that there comes a point in our lives when we are examining things, or questioning and wondering and those kinds of stuff. This is normal.
Yes, it is normal. It's Abraham Maslow, who's another psychologist from, I think, the 50s, talked about there's a different challenge at each developmental stage of life. And at midlife, it's stagnation versus generativity. Actually, it wasn't Maslow. It was Eric Erickson, a psychologist in the 50s, who talked about stagnation versus generativity. So It's like looking at, am I, like, when you kind of wake up to this, it's like, am I stagnating and just settling for a good enough life, settling for a safety and a security and mistaking that for happiness? Or this call, this pull, this almost seduction into evolution and growth and generativity, and like pull toward, like, what haven't I done yet? Like, what life haven't I lived yet? I want to wring life dry of all the juiciness it has to offer. And so there's a conflict there, because we've set up a stable life sometimes, and then we might want to shift something about that. And no, it doesn't mean you have to shift everything about it or have it be this entire crisis, but it's, you know, there's some call that happens internally, whether we choose to accept that invitation or ignore it.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, you talk about this call that happens, or this natural thing that happens when we get to that stage in life. I know I've spoken to some people, some friends of mine actually, who even, how do I say this? Even though they're not necessarily happy about what's happening in their lives, or maybe they're sensing a calling, or they're sensing a quaking or something, and yet they don't actually go there. They don't actually allow themselves to go there and ask the questions, because, as one friend of mine tells me, if she asks the questions, then she hears the answers. And good Lord, what now?
Right. Yes. I hear this a lot, actually, and I've felt it personally, and I hear it from others who come to me with this like curiosity about individual or group coaching that I do on these themes. And, you know, I've had people say to me, like, well, what if working with you changes everything? Or what if looking at this changes everything? And a lot of times people fear that it will. And a lot of times people fear that it won't, because they don't want to end up stagnant, you know, again, after doing this, like looking at it, excavating all of these like desires from themselves, and then say, oh, there's nothing actually that I could do about it, but now I can't unsee it, you know?
Right.
But, but I feel like in doing this work, like, I don't have an agenda that everything needs to change or that someone needs to blow up their lives whatsoever. But I wholeheartedly believe that looking deep inside for our own truths is a really important part of becoming a conscious human and having integrity with yourself, not lying to yourself. And then what you do with that information that you uncover is your own choice, because we all have agency to decide, you know, what we'll do once we know more about who we are and what we want and what we desire. But yeah, many women have never been asked what they want. And so they don't know how to even find the answer. Like, usually we're socialized to be wanted and to be needed, not to want or to need. So like when I ask clients, you know, what is it that you want, or what is the longing? Sometimes a lot of our work has to do with, where do I even look to find that? And so I help ask them the good kind of hard questions that can get to that. And I include a lot of those in my book as well. Yeah. But I don't know. I think that inquiry itself is a worthy pursuit, whether or not you're, you know, having this like mission or intention to like change your life entirely.
I remember when I first started going to see a therapist and, you know, like the first questions, or some of the first questions, initial sessions, and she would ask me like, what do you want? And I would go on and on about what I don't want. And she would always say, okay, I hear you. What do you like? Let's now shift to what you want. And I had such a hard time in the beginning. Like, it's easy for me to say what I don't want.
Yes.
Do you find that common?
Okay. I really do. I think people can really feel their no's more than their yeses. And they can really feel their like, well, whatever it is, I know I don't want this, 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 and this, because we've tried those things and we're usually fed up by those things, and we can name them pretty readily. But when it's like, what do I want? It's like, gosh, what am I allowed to want? And how big is the scope of this dream? And like, what is the reality of my life, and how much is that possible? So sometimes people are afraid to want it, because they're like, yeah, I want that. But, you know, I also have all these responsibilities that feel like weight. And how do I, even reconcile that? So it can be really vulnerable to say what you want when you're not sure how to go about getting it, or if you should.
I wanted to ask about your experience when you're talking with your clients, and you know, they go through the process of asking themselves these questions and they find answers that they're now going, okay, well, what do I do with this? Because I can't possibly leave my husband because I have my kids, right. Or I can't right. possibly quit my job because I've worked hard on this career, or I can't possibly right. move to a different state because I lived here all my life. Like, how do you help them go through that process? Or is yeah. there, I don't know how to phrase this, but is there a conclusion, if I could use that word, that says, okay, I know the answer, but I won't act on it? Is that even a possibility?
I think that there's this continuum sort of between like the safety and security of what's familiar, mm-hmm. and then the part of us that really does crave the, like what I was talking about before, like the evolution, the growth, the seduction, the mystery, the like, what is it I haven't done? And it doesn't mean like going from one extreme to the other all the time. It's sort mm-hmm. of like finding oh. that middle ground or this place where it's like, oh, this might actually satisfy. It doesn't have to be, oh, I'm going to leave my husband and move to Fiji and, you know, quit my job. Like it doesn't have to be the extreme version of all of that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I happen to have like a big shift in my own midlife emergence, you know, from my sexuality to my relationship status, to my career, to my mm-hmm. geographic location. Like I changed a lot in my 40s. But I don't find that that's like always necessary. I just mm-hmm. believe in helping people understand how they want to feel rather mm-hmm. than chasing the goal itself. And then helping them to make like 1 degree turns even toward mm-hmm. the feeling that they want that. Like, how would you feel if you attained that thing? What is that feeling? Okay, maybe it's freedom. So what can you do each day to generate the feeling of freedom? And these might just be smaller shifts. I sometimes tell people that when we begin to work together too, because it's like that fear that you spoke of earlier of like, well, what if I do this work and it makes me feel like I need to turn my life upside down. Right. And a lot of people have a readiness for change when they come to do this type of deep self-inquiry work anyway, where they're like, something has to change. Like, can you just help me figure out what it is, like what is sustainable and bearable? And a lot of people do end up making some shift in yeah. whatever area that is for them that yeah. is feeling really unsatisfying.
Yeah. Is it it's not a song. I think it's a quote. And I can't remember off the top of my head who said it, but something along the lines of don't let the song stay in your heart. Like something along those lines. I forget yeah. the whole entire quote. But as you were talking, I was saying it's one thing to kind of like feel that there's something you want to put out or something that you want to make happen for yourself with something that you want to do, not knowing what it is. But it's almost like a different level of pain when you know what it is that you want to do and yet you refuse to do it.
Right. Yeah, that is. You know? It is. It's like that sense of self-betrayal almost that yeah. can come in to those moments where you're like, I know better, or I know what's better for me. And then sort of not following your own intuition or authentic desire. And
yeah,
it's like, you know, making yourself uncomfortable in order for maybe others around you to be more comfortable or to keep the situation comfortable or not to rock the boat.
Yes.
And at your own expense, really. Right. It's like that quote about like, you know, setting yourself on fire to keep other people warm, but then you're just the one burning there.
Right, so. Right.
A quick interruption, my friend, to invite you to check out and subscribe to my publication, We're All Getting Older, or WAGO for short. WAGO is a newsletter, it's a resource, and a community for midlifers who are interested in getting better as we get older and become, you know, the best versions of ourselves. Check it out at blueblazer.com/newsletter. That's blueblazer.com/newsletter. And I hope to see you there soon. Let's get back to Jen.
I loved it in your book. You were very vulnerable and very open and transparent about the process that you went through and the journey that you went through. And I was just wondering, at the very beginning of it, mm-hmm. what this thing that we're talking about, this hesitancy to go there or the fear to further examine, the fear to really hear our answers to the questions. Did you ever feel yeah. that fear?
I did. For me, well, and most of my clients like are recovering good girls who've done all the right things and met all the right expectations and created the life that like we should want, but then still feeling unsatisfied. So I was like that in a sense of, you know, my life looked so good on paper and, you know, had my private practice going. I was living in California with my husband, who was my best friend, and we have an amazing kid and all of that. And it was like, I felt the shame of like, how could this not be enough? But it, there was something I just couldn't put aside anymore. And I felt like, you know, revealing that to myself, I couldn't unsee it once I saw it. It was like, well, I mean, I'd always known, and I guess I'll just say this too for listeners who haven't read my book or know my story. A big part of mine was around my sexuality, and I had known I was queer since I was young, actually, probably, but I didn't have a frame of reference for it being someone who, you know, was born in the 70s and grew up in the Southeast, you know, area in Virginia, and I was in a pretty conservative environment. And during that time, it just wasn't like, I didn't know any queer women. And I'd heard about, you know, gay men, but not in positive light. For me, it's like, I knew I had those feelings, but I was like, well, that's not a thing. That doesn't seem like an option. I'll just, you know, go along and do all the things and get straight A's and go to college and marry this awesome guy and have a house and a kid and do all of the expected stuff and, you know, create my career. And I always knew that. And it's something I told my husband, the man I ended up marrying, the day we met even, or the first week we knew each other. I was like, you know, I'd moved to New York. I'm like, I would like to be in a relationship with a woman now. Like, I feel like it's time. We ended up dating months after that eventually and, you know, got married. And it's like, he always knew that about me. So it wasn't a secret to myself, to him, or to my child, actually. But I had never felt the need to like act on it in a way, or like to have that be part of my reality in my life. But I think that's the part that just got really loud when I entered my 40s was like the feeling of the invisibility of this piece of my identity became so toxic and festering inside that I felt like I needed to do something with it. And I did not know what the answer to that was. So yeah, that was of course terrifying. And you know, I went very slowly through that entire process of self-examination, of working with him through that, working together on how we might, you know, help each other be the most free versions of ourselves, which is what our wedding vows said. And I feel like in keeping with our wedding vows, that's like why we got divorced, because that's the promise we made to each other, was to help each other be the most free. So, and we're still really close friends. He lives down the street and we co-parent our kid, and you know, there's grief there for sure, because there's a loss of the safety, security, the life that I had built. I still grieve that, and not in a regretful way. It's definitely in the sense of like, I know that what I did was the right thing for me. That's not something I could just put back away into a box and pretend that didn't exist and go on with life as it was.
Right.
But there's still grief in the loss of that. And alongside that, there's such beauty and freedom and getting to know myself in a different way through that whole process.
Oh my goodness. I wrote so many things I wanted to follow up on. One thing, I was wondering how, if you went through this and if you did, like how you processed it, and or how you might counsel your clients if they go through this guilt, this, because you mentioned it, like at the point in time when you were beginning to really ask these questions, everything on surface looked fine. You have a beautiful relationship with your husband, you have a daughter, you have a practice, you have a career. Like, what is there to complain about? Like, shouldn't we just be grateful for what we have and what, you know, that kind of thing. And if you went through that, you know, the guilt about questioning when everything seems fine and shouldn't you just be happy and grateful? And how did you go through that? And if you hear that from your clients as well, how would you counsel them?
Yeah, I think even the words you just used of shouldn't I just be grateful for what I have, and I have so much. I definitely have that voice in my head, and it's the voice of my mom and my grandmother. These are ways that I was conditioned to just be thankful for what I have. And I think that that is definitely a generational thing. And I feel like some of those patterns are being broken in my generation, and more so in my kids' generation after this. And I feel like it's not selfish. I had to really, really come to terms inside with the fact that wanting something for myself is not selfish. It's actually helping people to know more who I am so they can not only relate to me from a more true and real perspective rather than like, you know, something that is feeling fake or not like fully me. I'm not fully expressed in this life. So if I'm not fully expressed, how can you know me? How can I know you? And if I am standing in the fullness of my truth, it gives permission for those around me to do the same thing. I feel like that's what I hear the most about people reading my book. You know, they're like, wow, just the fact that you said this out loud means that I can say things out loud that are my truth. And that felt way more important to me than keeping things the same. And so, yeah, I mean, even in doing that, I do feel, I mean, guilt and shame get tangled to each other, but yeah, guilt is like, I did something bad, and shame is I am something bad. And so it's a shame, I feel like, is more the identity piece of like, I'm ashamed of who I am. And the guilt is like, oh, you know, I did the wrong thing. Yeah. And it's kind of both in that situation. And I do hear that from other people. Some people more the guilt, some people more the shame. I tend to look at things from an energetic perspective too. So one's like a second chakra shadow, one's like a third chakra shadow. So it's, yeah, I end up working with people on both of those feelings. And I've worked them so much in myself, and I can't say that they like fully have resolved in me, but, there's a framed quote. Lizzie Rusinko is this, hand lettering artist, and she has this quote that she hand lettered, and I have a print of it framed by my desk here, and I had it by me the whole time I wrote my book, and it says, the story you're ashamed to tell is the one that will set you free. And I mean, freedom's definitely one of my core values, but it's really around like overcoming that shame or doing it anyway, and helping other people realize that the shame is kind of a second arrow. There's already suffering. And if on top of the suffering, you're ashamed of the suffering, it's like, you don't need to have that with yourself or for yourself. So yeah, it's delicate and it's unique to each person. And yeah, it's definitely something I work with myself all the time as well.
As you were talking, I was thinking we can be grateful. So for example, you have a great career. Well, I am grateful for my great career, and I also want to pursue other things, or I am grateful. You know, it's the fact that I want to do something else or want to change a part of my life doesn't necessarily remove the fact that I am grateful for the stuff that I've been given, for the blessings, right? And so it's almost like holding both of those right together. Which leads me to my other thing that I wanted to ask you about. This, you use the word grief, which is, I think, you know, the fact that we've decided to change something in our lives doesn't mean that it's all, happy, la, 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 That there is also some sadness there because you're letting go of some part of yourself. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I, when you said that, it resonated very much with me. It, I walked away from a corporate career that I worked so hard for many, many years. And so even though I, like, I personally chose that path, or I chose to leave this, I felt very sad. And
yes, of course,
I felt the loss. So when you said grief, you know, it struck me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I would love to. I feel this is one of the trickier parts of my own story for me, I think, because I guess as it relates to my family of origin, like when I decided that I was going to make these changes based on the fact that I'm queer, which isn't a choice, it's an identity. And so because of my identity, I had to make a choice around what to do with my relationship and, you know, how that was going to look. And I didn't make that choice alone. I did that alongside my ex-husband. In doing that and telling my mom about that, and she's the kind of mom who's like, I just want you to be happy. I just want you to be happy. And then after that happened and she visited and she's like, you seem sad. I'm like, and I'm also happy. Like I am both. I'm holding all of these feelings at the same time because that's the wholeness of my humanness. And my aim is not to be happy. My aim is to be whole. And so I am grieving and I am free and I'm elated and I'm grieving. Like It's hard when you make a change and then people are like, oh, you seem so psyched now. And like the pressure to be so happy.
Yes.
Especially, you know, if you're like coming out and they're like, oh, you're full self now. And yeah, you should be totally happy. And I'm like, sure, I'm totally happy. But a lot of people who come out later in life also have let go of whatever they were doing earlier in life in order to do that. And it's such a hard thing to go through and overcome and then to renegotiate all of the relationships from the first part of life where people might have known you a different way. And then they're kind of watching to see like, do you seem happier now or not happier now? And then they're like, well, you did this yourself. And in a sense, yes, I did make the choice like you did with your job, but I did not choose to be queer.
Right,
you know,
right.
So there's that piece too. It's a little different in that way, but it's, So I get what you're saying. And I think it's confusing from the outside to watch someone grieve after they choose something that they think is best for them. And I think all of us can relate to it if we really look inside on some level and say, oh yeah, it makes sense. You'd be grieving. You let go of a lot for this. There's this quote that always comes up my social media feed. And I think it's like unattributed because I've looked it up, but it's like something about, you have to let go of your old life in order to embrace your new life. And every time I see it, I'm like, oh, like it stabs me in the heart. Cause I'm like, oh, I want my new life. And I loved my old life and all of that. So yeah, I'm trying to find a way to just be with all of those things at the same time and still love who I love from all the parts of my life.
Yes, yeah. You used the word liminal earlier, but there was a point, obviously our stories are different in the context and the nature of what we went through, the change that we went through. I do remember there was a point earlier after I've decided to walk away from this career that I was proud of and that my entire family was proud that I have and that couldn't understand why I'm rocking this boat. You know, like, what is the matter with you? But then after I've made the decision and they've accepted that I made this decision, I felt the pressure to be happy all the time,
right?
Because and the moments when I felt lost a bit, that because my whole entire identity was tied to my career, and so when I left that, I was like, who the heck am I right now? And I was shocked. I was actually going through a period of shock that I didn't I didn't realize how much of my identity was tied to that career. So that when it happened, the loss is like what was shocking to me. And I couldn't talk about it or show that I'm lost because what the hell, you know, you chose this. You rock this boat. So you can't possibly be complaining now. And so there was a period of time when I was going through that and hiding it and making it like I'm happy and I'm woo-hoo-hoo and, you know, everything is fun and I know exactly what I want to do and, you know, because I can't possibly.
Yeah, I relate to that so much. I mean, with my whole situation as well as like, you know, career situation, I've done similar, you know, jumps from corporate. I mean, I was a lot younger. It was kind of in my quarter life crisis, as they call that one, moving from a corporate job and going back to school or going to school for therapy. And yeah, similarly, like, it's like just being like, yeah, I have to be so decided and so strong and exactly, I know what I'm doing. Here I go. Yay. And then, you know, really on the inside questioning myself at every turn. Like, did I do
the
right
thing? This to be happy? So why get happy all the time? The other thing too that that struck me when I was reading your book is that I think he was the first person or one of the very first people that you spoke with was your husband when you realized that you're wanting to do this change, which to me was like, what a gift that you actually have this person in your life, your friend, you know, that you're connected with, that you could actually talk to honestly and be vulnerable with. And a question there is like two parts, right? So one is, was there ever a doubt? Because your decision is obviously, your realization that this is what's happening with you is obviously going to affect him. Yes. This is not just a friend who whose life isn't going to be affected. His life is going to be affected. So was there ever a doubt in your mind that this is the person I should discuss this with? So that's the first part. And then the second part is, what do we do when we don't have a friend like that?
Yeah, I come up against this with clients and friends. For me, I realized that being able to tell the man I was married to, like, immediately, really, like once I admitted to myself, and my book opens with a scene where I am realizing that myself and driving over to the coast and crying on my steering wheel, listening to Donnie DeFranco and realizing like, okay, this can't just stay inside anymore. What can I do? And it was so clear to me then, I didn't have a doubt that I just wanted to go talk to Craig, who is my ex-husband, because he's known me, you know, and has been with me for so long and knows this about me. It wasn't like that part was going to be a shock, right? Mm-hmm. My sexuality. But it feels like, I realize that's like a rare situation. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're still best friends is a rare situation as well. And I know that because I work with a lot of people who have similar, I work with a lot of people in midlife, and I also work with a lot of people coming out later in life in my practice, and people just going through divorce mm-hmm. in general and transitions. And a lot of times, the person that they can talk to isn't that person that they're coupled yeah. with. Maybe that there's a trusted friend. And in a lot of cases, it's having a coach like myself, or finding a therapist, or finding like an outside party who is, you know, neutral, and being able to like see the whole thing from a different perspective, and to offer just sort of ways of helping them turn toward themselves over and over again to find the answers. Yeah, I think that some people, you know, don't have the maybe luxury of having a Craig like yeah. I had. And some people do, and that goes okay too. I think just, you know, even though I'm thinking, actually, I was about to say this, and it's a quote from my very favorite poet, Andrea Gibson. And they say, even if the truth isn't hopeful, the telling of it is. And ooh, I fully believe that.
Yeah.
Because inviting someone in to know your truth and to relate to you from that place is like the most loving thing, like to tell the truth and to be in, like, it brings the connection deeper. And I try to do that in my life. And I think even if it's hard for some people, if they're in a safe situation where they can do that, I find that it helps to deepen the relationship or the bond with those people, even if the nature of their relationship ends up changing.
Do you find, like, I think the very first person who I spoke with about the changes that I wanted to make was my therapist, not anybody yeah. in my family. Do you find that that's right. common, that the person yes. that they tell first isn't a family member?
Yes. I think in my work, I tend to hear things first a lot yeah. of the time. And I have talked with my therapist and my coach first as mm-hmm. well for a lot of different things.
Right.
And I also, being trained as a therapist, the people I went through my cohort with are now my best friends. So my circle of best friends are all therapists. Kind of nice. So I end up being able to, when I talk with my best friends, they're therapists. And they, yeah, we do that with and for each other quite a bit.
Yeah,
as well.
That's nice. Yes, yes.
It is. But I also think like there's this expectation sometimes that we're going to tell our families first. And for me, in my particular story, and I find this with other people who might be in making a change that would rock the boat of their family culture or the ideals that they were conditioned into or grown up with, telling family of origin is often the final frontier because it's like, those are the voices that are already in your head. Like they're the parts in you that are the fear and doubt voices, or the ones that are saying, no, stay safe.
And, stay put.
You know,
yeah.
just be lucky that you have a job. Be lucky that you have this marriage. Be grateful, you know. And it's like, I had enough of that voice in me, so much so that it was making me arrested to change, like not being able to move forward. So I knew that I didn't need any more of that vote or any more of that voice in my ear on the phone. So it was like, let me actually do this. And then when I've come to my own decision about whatever it is I'm going to do, then I'm going to go to my family of origin and talk about it. And so I did it in that order for myself. And I find that a lot of the people I work with who are coming out later in life have a similar cadence to it because of the nature of that sometimes being not what their family expected, or, you know, might not be the most accepting of it. So I know that when I, you know, had already made some decisions and then ended up telling my mom, she's like, oh, don't you feel like you could have talked to me earlier? You know, that was like a different hard thing for her, understandably. And it was mm-hmm. like, I just knew I had to do it in that order for myself.
Yeah. I like what you said about our family of origin, or those who are closest to us, their voices are already in our heads, you know, mm-hmm. And usually the voices, I mean, I suppose that there are some who maybe their parents or whatever are into, you know, pushing you to do something different, or, I mean, but most of the time the voices are like, you know, more about staying put and you know,
we want safety for our kids. Yeah. I'm a mom. I understand that. Yeah. I want my kid to be safe.
Yeah.
And I also want them to grow. I'm really trying, but I know that there's that, and it's really well-intended instinct to protect your children.
Yeah. I know my sister, for example, I have an older sister who's like 20 years older than me. So she's like my second mom, and she's always like, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. So
you don't know, right?
Yeah. And so it's almost like, it's almost like, stay put, like just stay there. It's even if it's not, you're not very happy, at least you know the situation, you know? And I know, like, to your point, she says it with love. It comes from a place of love because she's worried about me. She doesn't want me to go in, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But it is the voice that says, you know, just stay. Just
yes.
Just stay.
Yeah.
Even if you're not entirely happy, it's better, at least, because at least you know.
Yes. It's like the known versus the unknown. And maybe the known is hell, but the unknown could be hell. We don't know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to chat with you a little bit too, Jen, about the process that you went through in writing the book. I mean, a lot of people say that writing a book is cathartic and all that kinds of stuff. You wrote a very open, vulnerable book. What did you tell your ex-husband and your daughter?
Yeah, well, my kid is non-binary now, so I'm using they, them pronouns for them. But, well, both were very encouraging. My ex-husband is such a big cheerleader for my work and for my book. And he read it before. He didn't want to read it until it was almost finished. And then he read it once I sent it to my publisher, but it hadn't come out yet. And he spent some days with it. And then we met up and he had pages of feedback for me. And it was all positive. It was all like, wow, this is so cool. And I love how you described that. Like, all of that was really, really wonderful and encouraging. But it's so hard to write a memoir when you know you're doing it from your own viewpoint, but it involves those people closest to you because they're in your story, because they're in your life, right? So it's like wanting to have responsibility to do that in a way that's respectful and to acknowledge that I'm telling the truth as I experienced it, and that they might have seen things from a different, they will have seen things from a different perspective because they're different people. And that just, it carries so much weight. And I lost a lot of sleep, honestly, when it was in the finalizing process of about to, you know, be printed and go. And I just was trying to navigate those emotions of it coming out into the world. And in the beginning of each chapter, I have a quote. In the beginning of, I think it's chapter 11, there's a quote by Georgia O'Keeffe that says, I've already settled it for myself. So flattery and criticism go down the same drain and I am quite free. And I love this. And I'm not there. I mean, it's total goals, but it takes the ego out of it just to stand in the knowing of who you are, like regardless of praise or criticism, both, right? Like sometimes we want the praise, but you know, and I'm so sensitive. And I kept thinking, like, this is so masochistic for me to write all of this messiness down for everyone to read and put that out there. But I feel like the truth telling, especially truth telling about this stage of life, is vital to our collective healing. I really think it's like invites deeper connection, deeper self-inquiry in people. And I really want to be part of the change, you know, where we're telling ourselves, well, we can tell each other just these messy truths about our lives. And then, you know, those are things that we might have been shamed for before, but like now it's like we're being set free from it, like the quote I said earlier. So I'm just hoping that it's standing in my truth, like however painful that is at times or has been over this past, you know, couple year process, few years process of like creating my book and then having it out in the world. I'm just hoping that inspires other people to at least claim their own truth and then maybe become visible in it if it's safe, maybe make changes if they want, you know. But
did you say it took you 2 years to write the book, or is it less than 2 years?
The book came out in April 2023. So it's been almost a year since it's been out. I wrote most of the book in 2020 and 2021. And then I sat on it for like a year. And then I was like, what's happening with this? I don't know. And then I ended up finding a publisher and working with them for, you know, about, and it was already finished. It was already had gone through all the rounds of editing, but worked with them for about 6 months to develop, you know, any further changes and to finalize it to be published. So yeah, so it's been a pretty long process, and it's kind of weird because a book is such a static object, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, this was the truth that I wrote down back, you know, 4 years ago, 3 years ago. And I read it now and I'm like, well, I've learned a lot since I wrote that down. But it's like people reading it are like, this is who you are now. Like,
yes, yeah.
Sure. And I'm continuing to evolve and continuing to emerge.
I think you wrote the last chapter like a couple years later or something like that, right? Something along those lines. Yes, yes.
I wrote like what I called an epilogue. I know that's not technically an epilogue, but in October of last year of 23.
Just before it came out.
A few months before it came out, because I wanted to save that to be, you know, a glance forward from what the reader was, you know, experiencing, just to say, okay, and now here's where I am. And
yeah.
The book came out. So
yeah,
I did that intentionally because I really wanted it to be a glimpse forward.
Yeah. I thought that was like just from a process of writing a book, I thought that was actually a very good idea because, like, to your point, you live with the story that happened in the past, however long it is. And that you need that sort of like, not that you need, but usually from the point in time that you finished it and to the point when it's actually coming out, there's like space there. Right. And so being able to give an update somehow, it was a great idea, I thought. So
thank you.
Aside from I was just wondering, first of all, is this your first book? So your memoir is your first book. So
it is my first book.
So what's the biggest takeaway for you? Just the process of writing a book. It could be about was it cathartic, or was it something else, or something else entirely?
It was definitely cathartic. I've always been, even when I was like 3 years old and I had my first little typewriter banging on that, I was like all through elementary school, I was writing little short stories and long stories. And I've always wanted to write a book, and I never really thought I would. And it was kind of cool that it just sort of happened that way during the pandemic, that I naturally started writing a book. And it was my first endeavor in the world of publishing. And it took a lot in terms of learning what that world is about. It's something that I love and wish were more sustainable as a career path for me. I feel like I'm just an expressive person, an artist, a writer. So I will always try to find ways of expressing myself. And I am still writing. It took me a while to want to write again after it came out. But last fall, I started a Substack that I post on weekly with new, I don't know, topics or these same themes, but with different perspectives. So that's called Prism, and it's on Substack. And that's been really juicy for me to just even be writing again on a regular basis that way.
Do you think you're going to write another book?
I would like to. I would like to be able to afford to. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of all parts of ourselves, right? And so can you talk a little bit about the artists? Well, of course, a writer is an artist, but the visual artist part of you a little bit.
Sure. That's also something that started when I was very small. And I wasn't formally trained in art, but I've always made art. And then in my late 20s, I decided to go to school to become a therapist, but specifically an art therapist. So my graduate program was...
I've not heard about that. What is an art therapist?
An art therapist. It's a therapist who uses art to help people reveal their unconscious to their conscious mind. And so it does it in a really safe and beautiful way. And I think there's a misnomer that like art therapists only work with children. I've always only worked, well, in grad school, I worked with kids for a minute, but I've worked with adults my entire career as an art therapist. So it was a twofold program of like transpersonal counseling, psychology, and art therapy. So I got trained in both. That's like talk therapy and art therapy, but from a spiritual perspective. I went to a Buddhist university called Naropa, which has an awesome program for art therapy. And that really helped for the artist in me to, I guess, find a place for the type of art I was making, for like expressive art, not necessarily art world kind of art, but really art that felt like it was a mirror for what was happening inside, because that's always how I'd used it. And I love helping other people do that as well. And I weave that into my coaching work. And like, and I did through my book too, inviting people into not only writing prompts, but also art activities and art invitations and interventions. So yeah, it's a big piece of me and who I am, and did the cover for my book, and continue to just use art.
Do you, for lack of a better phrase, sell your art like as a painting, as you know, that kind of stuff?
I do. I created a watercolor oracle deck back in 2016 that I've been selling on Etsy ever since. And also in my Etsy shop, I have these things called Soul Essence Portraits, which are custom commissioned art pieces of the style that you see on the cover of my book and what you see in the painting here behind me. I know that listeners can't see it, but I do custom commissions for people like that. And I also show my art here locally in Boulder, Colorado. I've had it at a few different galleries and stores and things.
So. You know, one question that I've been asking my guests of late is this thing about joy and how your perception or your understanding of joy has changed, if it has changed over the years, and where you might be finding joy these days.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when I was younger, I equated joy with happiness. Like I was saying, like my mom being like, I just want you to be happy. And then as I've aged, I think I've grown to feel the incompleteness of the word happy and the wholeness of the word joy. And I prefer the word joy over happy, I think, because for some reason in my mind, it allows for the wholeness and the full spectrum of human emotions like we were talking about before. And that just feels like just a welcome relief to me, that all parts of me or all emotions of me are welcome. So and like I don't have to be happy to be whole. So I think that, yeah, I feel wholeness when I experience awe. So that can be like when my cat lays on my chest and puts her paws around my neck, or you know, when I see something beautiful like a sunset or an emotional scene on TV, or even the grief of letting go of something beautiful, or when I listen to Andrea Gibson read a poem, or hear Brandi Carlile sing a song that I love, or, you know, things that cause me to feel and cause my heart to really open, I think is where I find joy.
That's awesome. All right. So Jen, where can we find you? You talked about your Substack, which I'm going to put a link to on the show notes, but where can we find you and your art and your work online?
Sure, a few places, but first I'll say my website's like the hub for all of it. So if you remember nothing else, it's my name. It's Jen Berlingo, J-E-N-B-E-R-L-I-N-G-O. And that goes to like my individual coaching, my group programs. I run some online like self-paced programs, my book, my art, everything's there. My book, Midlife Emergence, is available now wherever people want to buy books online. Or you can ask your local independent bookstore to order it because it's available that way. Amazon has it in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, which I read. And yeah, my Substack is called Prism. And you can just go to Substack and search for Jen Berlingo. It'll come up. And I post there every Monday for free. And then there's paid subscriptions that get all kinds of fun upgrades. And I'm all over social media. I prefer Instagram the most. My handles on social media, it's just my name, Jen Berlingo. And I post on Instagram like every day. So
awesome. Yeah. Well, Jen, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, thank you, Lou. I've loved talking with you. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank Jen again for joining me. Please check out the show notes for all of the relevant links. Show notes are at secondbreaks.com. I will be back in a couple of weeks with my thoughts about all the stuff that we talked about today. Please don't forget to subscribe to We're All Getting Older. Until then, keep on making your dent, my friend. Cool beans.